Today is Tuesday, November 2nd, and this is VOA's International Edition. I am Gina Ruoffo in Washington. Coming up in the next half hour, U.S. President Joe Biden pledges to cut greenhouse gas emissions by more than half by the end of the decade.
Will we do what is necessary? Will we seize the enormous opportunity before us? Will we condemn future generations to suffer?
U.S. House Democrats hope for a Tuesday vote on twin infrastructure bill.
This optimistic note that was struck by President Biden was certainly a lot more optimism than we expected here in Washington.
And the Taliban condemns the registration in the U.S. of the newly formed Afghan resistance group. We'll have these stories and more next on International Edition. Stay tuned. President Joe Biden on Monday sought to assure world leaders the United States will keep its promise to slash greenhouse gas emissions by more than half by the end of the decade, even as the key policy to ensure those reductions remain uncertain. Biden joined leaders from over 100 countries in Glasgow for the start of the COP26 climate conference, which kicked off on the heels of the G20 summit in Rome that concluded with a statement that urged, quote, meaningful and effective, unquote, action on climate change, but left huge works for negotiators to ensure an ambitious outcome.
We meet with the eyes of history upon us and the profound questions before us. It's simple. Will we act? Will we do what is necessary? Will we seize the enormous opportunity before us? Or will we condemn future generations to suffer? We are taking all these actions. The United States will be able to meet the ambitious target I set in the Leaders' Summit in Climate back in April, reducing U.S. emissions by 50 to 52% below 2005 levels by 2030. We'll demonstrate to the world the United States is not only back at the table, but hopefully leading by the power of our example. That's why today I'm releasing the U.S. long-term strategy, which presents a vision of achieving the United States' goal of net zero emissions economy-wide by no later than 2050.
That's U.S. President Joe Biden. President Joe Biden's speech committed the U.S. to an ambitious goal of a zero emission target and leading the world on efforts to mitigate the effects of climate change. For reactions to the speech, I spoke with VOA White House Bureau Chief Patsy Widas-Kuwara, who is traveling with President Biden.
He outlined a set of new climate commitments building on previous global agreements. He said there's going to be a $3 billion plan for tackling climate financing and essentially helping poorer countries, developing nations to mitigate climate change as well as transition to more climate-friendly renewable energy. But the point is that, you know, this $3 billion is already part of the larger $11.4 billion that he announced in September. And that's not real money yet. Congress has to approve that funding, and so far they haven't. So right now, it's still just statements and commitments, and it's not real action plan just yet.
Have you been able to gauge reaction of, for instance, your colleagues or maybe the White House?
I think overall the sense is that the other representatives of the 120 plus countries that are here, they're happy that the U.S. is back and the U.S. is committing to these climate action plans to reduce global warming. But the overall mood of the summit is not super optimistic, obviously, because China and Russia have not announced any new pledges. In fact, they're not here in person and just submitting written statements. So there's a certain disappointment. There's a certain pessimism in terms of trying to achieve global targets. So there's definitely a disappointment, particularly considering the fact that China and Russia, two of the world's largest emitters, not only are not showing up in person, but are only just giving out written statements and not offering any kind of new commitments in terms of their efforts to slash down greenhouse emissions. So this is a heavy weight on the COP26, and it's just a lot of heavy lifting that the delegates have to do in order to come up with some sort of communique, some sort of a statement that will be strong enough to continue the momentum going forward.
This is the first in-person conference, as large as it is. We are reporting over 100 leaders or heads of governments there. And with COVID, what has it been like? Is there any particular protocol
The regular health protocols such as masking and testing and, well, not so much social distancing because people are everywhere. But I think vaccination is definitely a big key. I mean, nobody can get in here without showing a vaccination card, without showing in their test result. So people are being very careful and observing all these health protocols. But yes, you're absolutely right. This is still something that's being held under the threat of the pandemic. And in fact, just yesterday, White House Press Secretary Jen Psaki announced that the reason why she's not on this trip with the president is because she herself has tested positive for COVID. So certainly the pandemic is not behind us.
That's VOA White House Bureau Chief Patsy Widas-Kuwara traveling with President Biden. She spoke with me from Edinburgh, Scotland. Democratic leaders were hoping for a House vote as soon as Tuesday on the two pillars of President Joe Biden's domestic agenda. Two Democrats said on Saturday, as the party mounted its latest push to maneuver the long-delayed legislation through Congress. It remained unclear, though, whether the ambitious timetable could be met. Top Democrats would have liked a final House-Senate compromise on Biden's now $1.75 trillion 10-year social and environmental plan to be written by last Sunday, the Democrats said. For more, I spoke with VOA congressional correspondent Catherine Gibson.
This optimistic note that was struck by President Biden was certainly a lot more optimism than we expected here in Washington, because this entire negotiation process over these two big pieces of legislation that will form the important part of his first year agenda has really been taking a lot longer than congressional Democrats had hoped. So to break it down, there are actually two different bills. The first is an infrastructure bill. The second is a larger social safety net bill. And each one of those is dependent on the other for passage, because House progressives are arguing that there need to be even more spending in the social safety net package in order for them to want to go ahead and pass the infrastructure package. Democrats' margins in both the House of Representatives and the U.S. Senate are incredibly narrow, so they need every Democrat to buy in on both of these pieces of legislation. And that's been the holdup so far in these past few months, and the reason why we're just maybe getting to the point where they can be passed.
The sense of optimism appears to be growing, aside from President Biden. Some of the progressives appear to be leaning towards passage of the bill because of its long-term implications on the Democratic Party brand.
That's right. So we got some encouraging signals from House progressives over the weekend after they held a virtual meeting with each other to really talk out how this vote would go down in the next few days. They have signaled that they are getting what they want in that bigger piece of legislation, and in return, they will give their vote for the infrastructure package. We know that a lot of the elements in that bigger social safety net package are things like funding for climate change jobs that will address the issue of climate change, funding for childcare, paid leave. Really, we're talking about a very ambitious social safety net package if this thing does indeed go through. And by all indications, it will probably not go through early this week, but Democrats are hoping that it'll at least pass by later this week.
And what has been the political damage to the Democratic Party on these reversals and false hopes? Ultimately, the Republicans are laughing that the Democrats are unable to get anything done.
The deal isn't done yet, and the Republicans would have an opportunity to criticize if everyone leaves for the holiday break at the end of December. Democrats still have a little bit of time left to negotiate. And they know this is key because it is a huge part of President Biden's first year agenda. It's the way he will go out and other Democrats will go out starting in 2022, which is a midterm election year, when they can say, look to the American people, this is what we did for you in Washington. This is why we should be reelected in the midterms and maintain our control of both chambers of Congress. That is a key argument for them to make. What's more up for debate is whether or not Americans have been paying attention to every single moment of this negotiation process. What the Biden administration is hoping is that they can secure this deal. Then they can have that moment where they go out and say to the American people, this is what we've done for you. Of course, that's not done until it's done, until that vote happens in the House of Representatives and the U.S. Senate.
Is it a given that if this bill skips through the House, it will scale through the Senate, especially giving what some call the wild cards that are Senators Sinema and Manchin.
Really all comes down to those two senators, and they have been in deep negotiations with the Biden White House to make sure that they get the balance that they need to sway their votes over to the Democratic side. I think we're going to be watching this up until the very last minute for that vote.
That's VOA Congressional Correspondent Catherine Gibson speaking with me from Washington. U.S. Transportation Secretary Pete Buttigieg is defending the bill in the face of fierce Republican opposition. Michelle Quinn reports.
What we have in front of us right now, this is not half a loaf. It is a feast of good policy. It is the most transformative legislation for families, for healthcare, for climate that we've seen, certainly in my lifetime. And it's going to be an extraordinary achievement as soon as we can get it to the president's desk.
With divisions between Democratic progressives and moderates, the long-delayed legislation has come down in size, with spending on paid family leave among programs cut. On the climate front, it still includes tax credits for the use of cleaner fuels and electrified vehicles, money to address extreme weather, and tax incentives for renewable energy such as wind and solar power. Higher taxes on the wealthy and other measures will pay for the programs, but the public, perhaps weary of the months-long negotiations, may have stopped paying attention. Almost 70% say they know just some or little to nothing about what's in the legislation and a separate bipartisan infrastructure package, according to a new ABC Ipsos poll. Republican leaders remain opposed to the spending package. Kevin McCarthy, a Republican, is the House Minority Leader.
Trillions of dollars in spending, major expansions of government agencies, and even more inflation that will lead to higher costs for all Americans. Those are all on the table. Yet the details change by the minute.
Without any Republican votes, Biden will need all the Democrats' support in the 50-50 Senate, with Vice President Kamala Harris available to break a tie and lose no more than three more Democratic votes in the House of Representatives. Michelle Quinn, VOA News.
The Taliban has condemned the registration in the U.S. of a newly formed armed resistance group known as the National Resistance Front. Washington had denied official backing for the group that seeks to form what they call a national inclusive government to replace the Taliban's strict Islamic rule. For more on the implications of the registration, I spoke with VOA's Ayaz Garg in Islamabad.
Taliban obviously have come out and reacted sort of in a way to downplay the significance of this resistance force, which is called National Resistance Front. And they have also claimed that U.S. officials in direct negotiations with the Taliban recently have conveyed to the Taliban that there's no involvement or the U.S. government itself is not involved or encouraging such activities. But the laws in the United States are such that any such entity can be registered with the United States to conduct political activities. So this is what the Taliban are saying, but obviously it's not a good omen for the Taliban new government in Kabul that this force, which has its strong base in the northern Panjshir province and is known for challenging the past Taliban government. So definitely it's an additional headache for the Taliban, which are already trying to suppress the rising threat of the Islamic State militants in the country. This security challenge is definitely not a good sign for the Taliban, who are desperate to convince the world that they are in total control of Afghanistan.
Is this new group different from an earlier anti-Afghan resistance force in the Panjshir Valley that tried and failed to militarily confront the Afghan government?
The previous one was sort of population that had risen against the government at the time. But this one is force which is comprising former members of this Afghan security force that was trained by the United States, and some militia forces have joined hands to try to put up some kind of a resistance to the Taliban rule. So it is widely believed that the kind of support the previous resistance force had, this one really does not enjoy it. And the primary reason is that at that time, it was Russia and Central Asian neighbors of Afghanistan, which were supporting that resistance force militarily and with funding. But whether Russia and regional countries would want to have this continued instability in Afghanistan if they support any such resistance force now, when they are trying to encourage the Taliban and support the Taliban to stabilize Afghanistan so that the threat of terrorism could be suppressed through collective effort of the regional countries and Afghanistan's Taliban rulers, especially with these devastating attacks that the Afghan branch of Islamic State has recently carried out. What they say in their announcements and statements recently that they want to achieve a stable Afghanistan through a process which is inclusive, which represents all the ethnic minorities of Afghanistan, and they basically are not approving the Taliban's control over Afghanistan. And you know, Taliban is there predominantly ethnic Pashtuns, the majority community in Afghanistan. So there is a traditional rivalry between this Pashtun dominance and the Tajik minority community, which is actually claiming to be representing the Tajik community under this National Resistance Front that has been registered with the United States. This front is basically seeking international support and trying to convince the world community that Taliban's control over Afghanistan would mean continued instability and more civil war-like hostilities.
Seems this new group wants to drag the United States back into the affairs of Afghanistan. Why register in the United States? Why not in any other country in Europe or neighboring India or even Pakistan?
Pakistan has had better relations with the Taliban traditionally, because all the provinces of Afghanistan which border with Pakistan, they are all Pashtun dominated areas. So Pakistan has this traditional closeness with this community in Afghanistan. So there's no question for them to have any support in Pakistan. And Iran and Russia and China, you know, all of these countries this time around have thrown their weight behind the Taliban to support the Taliban, because they think that with Taliban in control, they will be able to prevent Islamic State militants from threatening regional countries. At the same time, Tajik Northern Resistance Front, obviously knowing that there is lesser support from within the region, and there's a lot of activity going on. Even in U.S. Congress, there has been a lot of support for women in Afghanistan and for minority groups in Afghanistan. So maybe this is the thinking that they have behind their effort to have some kind of a political activity or office in the United States, that they may be able to lobby, you know, congressmen and get some support.
That's VOA's Ayaz Gaur speaking with me from Islamabad. U.S. Secretary of State Anthony Blinken says he's alarmed over reports that rebellious Tigrayan forces have captured two towns in the neighboring Amhara region. David Doyle of Reuters has more.
U.S. Secretary of State Anthony Blinken says he is alarmed by reports that forces from Ethiopia's Tigray have taken over two key towns. The Tigray People's Liberation Front said on Sunday its fighters were in control of Kombolchar and its airport, having claimed the capture of Desi the day before, which the government denied. Both are located in Amhara, which neighbours the northern Tigray region. On Monday, Ethiopia's government communication service said Tigrayan forces had summarily executed 100 youths in Kombolchar. TPLF spokesperson Getachew Reda denied the allegation, saying there was no resistance in Kombolchar. An Ethiopian government spokesman did not immediately reply to a request for comment on Getachew's response, but had earlier referred Reuters back to the government statement. Verifying such accounts is difficult, as communications to the area are down and journalists barred. Kombolchar would be a strategic gain for the Tigrayan forces in the nearly year-long conflict with the federal military and its allies. It's located on a major highway around 235 miles from Addis Ababa. If confirmed, the seizure would be the closest to the capital and the furthest south into Amhara that Tigrayan forces have reached since pushing into the region in July. Speaking on Monday, Blinken said continued fighting was prolonging a dire humanitarian crisis in northern Ethiopia. He urged all parties to cease military operations and begin a ceasefire without preconditions. Thousands have died since the conflict broke out, and more than 2 million have been forced to flee their homes.
That's David Doyle of Reuters. French President Emmanuel Macron says Australian Prime Minister Scott Morrison lied to him over the cancellation of his submarine building contract in September. Libby Hogan of Reuters reports.
French President Emmanuel Macron said Australia's leader, Scott Morrison, lied to him over a cancelled submarine contract. It's the latest shot fired between the two countries, as both leaders were in Rome for the G20, meeting for the first time since Australia ditched the multi-billion dollar deal with France. Macron spoke to a group of Australian reporters on the sidelines of the summit.
I have a lot of respect for your country. I have a lot of respect and a lot of friendship for your people. I do say when we have respect, you have to be true and you have to behave in line and consistently with this value.
Do you think he lied to you?
I don't think. I know.
Australia formed a new security alliance with Britain and the US known as AUKUS in September. They then announced a new order for nuclear-powered submarines. Macron says AUKUS caught them off guard, and later France recalled its ambassadors from Washington and Canberra. Speaking at the conference, Morrison then fired back at Macron. He said he had explained to Macron that the conventional submarines would no longer meet Australia's needs and that they were already rebuilding their ties. On Friday, US President Joe Biden said he had thought France had been informed of the contract cancellation before the AUKUS pact was announced, but that the handling of the new agreement had been clumsy.
That's Libby Hogan of Reuters. Australians have been allowed to travel overseas without COVID-19 restrictions for the first time in almost 600 days. Previously, they needed government permission to go overseas under strict measures designed to curb the spread of the coronavirus. From Sydney, Phil Mercer reports.
After more than 18 months, Australia is reconnecting with the world as vaccination rates increase. There were tearful reunions at Sydney Airport as the first overseas passengers landed after restrictions came to an end. Australians can now travel freely overseas without needing official permission. Returning travellers flying home into the states of New South Wales and Victoria no longer face mandatory hotel quarantine. They must, however, be double vaccinated, and only Australian citizens, permanent residents and their immediate families can return home at this stage. Australia will reopen quarantine-free entry to fully vaccinated Singaporeans from November 21. But it's unclear when other foreign nationals, who've been mostly banned since March 2020, will be permitted to enter. Thousands of Australians have been stranded overseas during the pandemic by some of the world's toughest border controls. Authorities placed limits on the number of travellers allowed back because of constraints on the quarantine system. Melbourne Airport has also been preparing for the resumption of large-scale passenger numbers. Chief Executive Lyle Strambi says pandemic border closures have been hard on staff.
We haven't really stopped flying, so we've been able to keep things working and making sure that everything's in great shape. But the stop-start nature of the whole episode we've been through has been, you know, really tough. In particular, you know, for the employees at the airport, we'd normally have 20,000 people working at the airport. I think a few times there were down to as low as 500 people. So it's been really hard on those individuals in particular.
Internal border controls remain in parts of Australia. Residents in Sydney and Melbourne, for example, can now fly freely to Paris, France, but not to Perth in Western Australia. Travellers from New South Wales and Victoria, which have been at the centre of Delta variant outbreaks this year, can only enter Western Australia with an approved exemption permit and must be double vaccinated. Queensland state authorities plan to ease their internal border restrictions on December 17. Australia has diagnosed 170,000 coronavirus cases during the pandemic. 1,700 people have died. More than 77% of eligible Australians have been fully vaccinated. Phil Mercer for VOA News, Sydney.
Somalia has kicked off its indirect elections for the lower house parliament. The vote was delayed several times due to disagreements among Somali political leaders on the process. Mohamed Kahir reports from Mogadishu.
Somalia's delayed lower house elections commenced Monday in Mogadishu. Each seat in 275 house will be selected by a group of 101 electoral delegates chosen by Somalia's clans. One group gathered in a person at a hall in Mogadishu on Monday. Others will gather at a site across the country to conduct the polls, all by secret ballot. Militant group Al-Shabaab has threatened to disrupt the vote, so each site is protected by Somali security agencies and the African Union peacekeepers. Deputy Prime Minister Mahdi Mohamed Guleid from the Somaliland region was the first member to win in a landslide victory. He said the democratic process is a key to stability in the country. He said electoral process is the only way to a peaceful coexistence among the citizens, as well as enhancing or reviewing the governance administration in power. He appealed for a smooth process for the remaining votes before December to pave way for presidential elections. Somalia's Federal Poll Management Agency said it will ensure designated groups, such as women, are allocated seats in parliament. He said the commission will ensure 30% or more women quota in the lower house elections, while urging the states across the country to speed up the process. Members of the upper house of parliament were chosen last month. The 329 Somali legislatures are expected to elect the next president sometime before the end of the year. The term of the incumbent President Mohamed Abdullahi Mohamed expired in February, but the constitution stipulated he stay in office until lawmakers choose his successor. Mohamed Kahir for VOA News in Mogadishu, Somalia.
In other news, anticipating a green light from vaccine advisors, the Biden administration is assembling and shipping millions of COVID-19 shots for children ages 5 to 11, the White House said on Monday. The first could go into kids' arms by midweek. Coronavirus coordinator Jeff Zients said, quote, "We are not waiting on the operations and logistics," unquote. By vaccinating children, the U.S. hopes to head off another coronavirus wave during the cold weather months when people spend time indoors and respiratory illness can spread more rapidly. Cases have been declining for weeks, but the virus has repeatedly shown its ability to stage a comeback, and more easily transmissible mutations are a persistent threat. On Tuesday, a special advisory panel to the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention will meet to consider detailed recommendations for administering the Pfizer-BioNTech vaccine to younger children. The Food and Drug Administration already cleared the shots, which deliver about one-third of the vaccine given to adults. After CDC advisors make their recommendations, agency director Dr. Rochelle Walensky will give the final order. Zien said the government has enough of the Pfizer vaccine for all 28 million children in the 5 to 11 age group. He said during the briefing, quote, "We're in great shape on supply," unquote. You are listening to VOA's International Edition. I am Chinedu Afor. Researchers in Indonesia have found a way to fight disease-bearing mosquitoes by breeding a species of the insect which carries a kind of bacteria that prevents viruses like dengue from growing inside. Brian Wood of Reuters reports.
Researchers in Indonesia are fighting mosquito-borne diseases with more mosquitoes, but these are carrying a secret weapon. A joint study has been releasing lab-bred mosquitoes in the city of Yogyakarta, targeting red zones for dengue fever. But these bugs carry Wolbachia, a common bacteria found in over half of insect species that prevents viruses like dengue from growing inside them. It's not, however, found in Aedes aegypti mosquitoes, which often carry dengue, according to the nonprofit World Mosquito Program. Purwanti is with the group.
In principle, we are breeding the good mosquitoes. The mosquitoes carrying dengue will mate with mosquitoes carrying the Wolbachia bacteria, and we hope to produce Wolbachia mosquitoes, or the good ones.
WMP trial results showed this method reduced dengue cases by nearly 80% and hospitalizations by nearly 90%. Sri Purwangsi is a local in Yogyakarta and a research volunteer.
All three of my children have been infected with dengue and hospitalized. It's always on my mind, thinking about how to keep my village healthy.
Global dengue infections have risen rapidly in recent decades, according to the World Health Organization. About half of the world's population is now at risk, with an estimated 100 to 400 million infections reported every year.
That's Brian Wood of Reuters. This has been International Edition on The Voice of America. On behalf of the entire production team, thank you so much for listening. Visit our website for in-depth coverage of world events and news 24 hours a day at voanews.com. Until next time, I am Chinedu Afo in Washington, and here's wishing you a great week ahead.